Chapter 33. The Venetian gondola is as free and graceful in its gliding movement as a serpent. It is 20 or 30 feet long and is narrow and deep, like a canoe. Its sharp bow and stern sweep upward from the water like the horns of a crescent, with the abruptness of the curve slightly modified. The bow is ornamented with a steel comb with a battle-axe attachment, which threatens to cut passing boats in two occasionally, but never does. The gondola is painted black, because in the zenith of Venetian magnificence the gondolas became too gorgeous altogether, and the Senate decreed that all such display must cease, and a solemn, unembellished black be substituted. If the truth were known, it would doubtless appear that rich plebeians grew too prominent in their affectation of patrician show on the Grand Canal, and required a wholesome snubbing. Reverence for the hallowed past and its traditions keeps the dismal fashion in force now that the compulsion exists no longer. So let it remain. It is the color of mourning. Venice mourns. The stern of the boat is decked over and the gondolier stands there. He uses a single oar, a long blade, of course, for he stands nearly erect. A wooden peg, a foot and a half high, with two slight crooks or curves in one side of it, and one in the other, projects above the starboard gunwale. Against that peg the gondolier takes a purchase with his oar, changing it at intervals to the other side of the peg, or dropping it into another of the crooks, as the steering of the craft may demand, and how in the world he can back and fill, shoot straight ahead, or flirt suddenly around a corner, and make the oar stay in those insignificant notches, is a problem to me, and a never diminishing matter of interest. I am afraid I study the gondolier's marvelous skill more than I do the sculptured palaces we glide among. He cuts a corner so closely, now, and then, or misses another gondola by such an imperceptible hairbreadth, that I feel myself scrooching, as the children say, just as one does when a buggy wheel grazes his elbow. But he makes all his calculations with the nicest precision, and goes darting in and out among a Broadway confusion of busy craft with the easy confidence of the educated hackman. He never makes a mistake. Sometimes we go flying down the great canals at such a gait that we can get only the merest glimpses into front doors, and again, in obscure alleys in the suburbs, we put on a solemnity suited to the silence, the mildew, the stagnant waters, the clinging weeds, the deserted houses and the general lifelessness of the place, and move to the spirit of grave meditation. The gondolier is a picturesque rascal for all he wears no satin harness, no plumed bonnet, no silken tights. His attitude is stately, he is lithe and supple, all his movements are full of grace. When his long canoe, and his fine figure, towering from its high perch on the stern, are cut against the evening sky, they make a picture that is very novel and striking to a foreign eye. We sit in the cushioned carriage body of a cabin, with the curtains drawn, and smoke, or read, or look out upon the passing boats, the houses, the bridges, the people, and enjoy ourselves much more than we could in a buggy jolting over our cobblestone pavements at home. This is the gentlest, pleasantest locomotion we have ever known. But it seems queer ever, so queer, to see a boat doing duty as a private carriage. We see businessmen come to the front door, step into a gondola instead of a streetcar, and go off downtown to the counting dash room. We see visiting young ladies stand on the stoop, and laugh, and kiss goodbye, and flirt their fans, and say, "Om soon, now do, you've been just as mean as ever you can be, mother's dying to see you, and we've moved into the new house, oh such a love of a place. So convenient to the post office and the church, and the Young Men's Christian Association, and we do have such fishing, and such carrying on, and such swimming dash matches in the backyard, oh, you must come no distance at all, and if you go down through by St. Mark's and the Bridge of Sighs, and cut through the alley, and come up by the Church of Santa Maria dei Frari, and into the Grand Canal, there isn't a bit of current, now do come, Sally Maria, bye-bye." And then the little humbug trips down the steps, jumps into the gondola, says, under her breath, disagreeable old thing, I hope she won't. Goes skimming away, round the corner, and the other girl slams the street door and says, well, that infliction's over, anyway, but I suppose I've got to go and see her tiresome stuck-up thing. Human nature appears to be just the same, all over the world. We see the diffident young man, mild of mustache, affluent of hair, indigent of brain, elegant of costume, drive up to her father's mansion, tell his hackman to bail out and wait, start fearfully up the steps and meet the old gentleman right on the threshold. Hear him ask what street the new British bank is in, as if that were what he came for, and then bounce into his boat, and scurry away with his coward's heart in his boots. See him come sneaking around the corner again, directly, with a crack of the curtain open toward the old gentleman's disappearing gondola, and out scampers his Susan with a flock of little Italian endearments fluttering from her lips, and goes to drive with him in the watery avenues down toward the Rialto. We see the ladies go out shopping, in the most natural way, and flit from street to street, and from store to store, just in the good old fashion, except that they leave the gondola, instead of a private carriage, waiting at the curbstone a couple of hours for them, waiting while they make the nice young clerks pull down tons and tons of silks and velvets and moire antiques and those things. And then they buy a paper of pins, and go paddling away, to confer the rest of their disastrous patronage on some other firm. And they always have their purchases sent home just in the good old way. Human nature is very much the same all over the world, and it is so like my dear native home to see a Venetian lady go into a store, and buy 10 cents worth of blue ribbon, and have it sent home in a sco. Ah, it is these little touches of nature that move one to tears in these far-off foreign lands. We see little girls and boys go out in gondolas with their nurses, for an airing. We see state families, with prayer book and beads, enter the gondola dressed in their Sunday best, and float away to church. And at midnight we see the theater break up, and discharge its swarm of hilarious youth and beauty. We hear the cries of the hackman gondoliers, and behold the struggling crowd jump aboard, and the black multitude of boats go skimming down the moonlit avenues. We see them separate here and there, and disappear up divergent streets. We hear the faint sounds of laughter, and of shouted farewells floating up out of the distance. And then, the strange pageant being gone, we have lonely stretches of glittering water, of stately buildings, of blotting shadows, of weird stone faces creeping into the moonlight, of deserted bridges, of motionless boats at anchor. And over all broods that mysterious stillness, that stealthy quiet, that befits so well this old dreaming Venice. We have been pretty much everywhere in our gondola. We have bought beads and photographs in the stores, and wax matches in the great square of St. Mark. The last remark suggests a digression. Everybody goes to this vast square in the evening. The military bands play in the center of it, and countless couples of ladies and gentlemen promenade up and down on either side, and platoons of them are constantly drifting away toward the old cathedral, and by the venerable column with the winged lion of St. Mark on its top, and out to where the boats lie moored. And other platoons are as constantly arriving from the gondolas and joining the great throng. Between the promenaders and the sidewalks are seated hundreds and hundreds of people at small tables, smoking and taking granita, a first cousin to ice cream. On the sidewalks are more employing themselves in the same way. The shops in the first floor of the tall rows of buildings that wall in three sides of the square are brilliantly lighted, the air is filled with music and merry voices, and altogether the scene is as bright, and spirited and full of cheerfulness as any man could desire. We enjoy it thoroughly. Very many of the young women are exceedingly pretty, and dress with rare good taste. We are gradually and laboriously learning the ill manners of staring them unflinchingly in the face, not because such conduct is agreeable to us, but because it is the custom of the country and they say the girls like it. We wish to learn all the curious, outlandish ways of all the different countries, so that we can awe and astonish people when we get home. We wish to excite the envy of our untraveled friends with our strange foreign fashions which we can't shake off. All our passengers are paying strict attention to this thing, with the end in view which I have mentioned. The gentle reader will never, never know what a consummate ass he can become, until he goes abroad. I speak now, of course, in the supposition that the gentle reader has not been abroad, and therefore is not already a consummate ass. If the case be otherwise, I beg his pardon, and extend to him the cordial hand of fellowship, and call him brother. I shall always delight to meet an ass after my own heart, when I shall have finished my travels. On this subject let me remark, that there are Americans abroad in Italy who have actually forgotten their mother tongue in 3 months, forgot it in France. They cannot even write their address in English in a hotel register. I append these evidences, which I copied verbatim from the register of a hotel in a certain Italian city. Own P. Whitcomb, edits on this. M. 50. Ainsworth. Traveler, he meant traveler, I suppose. Edits on this. Erge P. Morton A. Fills, d'Amérique. Lloyd B. Williams, A. Troyce Amos, Ville de Boston, Amérique. Dot Ellsworth Baker, Tout de Suite de France. Place de Naissance Amérique, destination La Grande Bretagne. I love this sort of people. A lady passenger of ours tells of a fellow dash citizen of hers who spent 8 weeks in Paris, and then returned home, and addressed his dearest old bosom friend Herbert as Mr. Herbert. He apologized, though, and said, "Pon my soul, it is aggravating. But I can't help it, I have got so used to speaking nothing but French, my dear Herbert, damn, there it goes again. Got so used to French pronunciation, that I can't get rid of it, it is positively annoying, I assure you." This entertaining idiot, whose name was Gordon, allowed himself to be hailed 3 times in the street, before he paid any attention, and then begged 1,000 pardons, and said he had grown so accustomed to hearing himself addressed as Sugar R. Dong, with a roll to the R, that he had forgotten the legitimate sound of his name. He wore a rose in his buttonhole. He gave the French salutation 2 flips of the hand in front of the face. He called Paris Paris in ordinary English conversation. He carried envelopes bearing foreign postmarks protruding from his breast pocket. He cultivated a mustache and imperial, and did what else he could to suggest to the beholder his pet fancy, that he resembled Louis Napoleon, and in a spirit of thankfulness which is entirely unaccountable, considering the slim foundation there was for it, he praised his maker, that he was as he was, and went on enjoying his little life just the same, as if he really had been deliberately designed, and directed by the great architect of the universe. Think of our Whitcombs, and our Ainsworths and our Williamses writing themselves down in dilapidated French in foreign hotel registers. We laugh at Englishmen, when we are at home, for sticking so sturdily to their national ways and customs, but we look back upon it from abroad very forgivingly. It is not pleasant to see an American thrusting his nationality forward obtrusively in a foreign land, but oh, it is pitiable to see him making of himself a thing that is neither male nor female, neither fish, flesh, nor fowl, a poor, miserable, hermaphrodite Frenchman. Among a long list of churches, art galleries, and such things, visited by us in Venice, I shall mention only one, the Church of Santa Maria dei Frari. It is about 500 years old, I believe, and stands on 1,200,000 piles. In it lie the body of Canova and the heart of Titian, under magnificent monuments. Titian died at the age of almost 100 years. A plague which swept away 50,000 lives was raging at the time, and there is notable evidence of the reverence in which the great painter was held, in the fact that to him alone the state permitted a public funeral in all that season of terror and death. In this church, also, is a monument to the Doge Foscari, whose name a once resident of Venice, Lord Byron, has made permanently famous. The monument to the Doge Giovanni Pesaro, in this church, is a curiosity in the way of mortuary adornment. It is 80 feet high, and is fronted like some fantastic pagan temple. Against it stand four colossal Nubians, as black as night, dressed in white marble garments. The black legs are bare, and through rents in sleeves and breeches, the skin, of shiny black marble, shows. The artist was as ingenious as his funeral designs were absurd. There are two bronze skeletons bearing scrolls, and two great dragons uphold the sarcophagus. On high, amid all this grotesqueness, sits the departed Doge. In the conventual buildings attached to this church, are the state archives of Venice. We did not see them, but they are said to number millions of documents. They are the records of centuries of the most watchful, observant and suspicious government that ever existed, in which everything was written down, and nothing spoken out. They fill nearly 300 rooms. Among them are manuscripts from the archives of nearly 2,000 families, monasteries and convents. The secret history of Venice for 1,000 years is here: its plots, its hidden trials, its assassinations, its commissions of hireling spies and masked bravos, food, ready to hand, for a world of dark and mysterious romances. Yes, I think we have seen all of Venice. We have seen, in these old churches, a profusion of costly and elaborate sepulchre ornamentation such as we never dreamed of before. We have stood in the dim religious light of these hoary sanctuaries, in the midst of long ranks of moldy monuments, and effigies of the great dead of Venice, until we seem drifting back, 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 into the solemn past, and looking upon the scenes and mingling with the peoples of a remote antiquity. We have been in a half-waking sort of dream all the time. I do not know how else to describe the feeling. A part of our being has remained still in the 19th century, while another part of it has seemed in some unaccountable way walking among the phantoms of the 10th. We have seen famous pictures until our eyes are weary with looking at them, and refuse to find interest in them any longer. And what wonder, when there are 1,200 pictures by Palma the Younger in Venice and 1,500 by Tintoretto. And behold their artisans and the works of other artists in proportion. We have seen Titian's celebrated Cain and Abel, his David and Goliath, his Abraham's sacrifice. We have seen Tintoretto's monster picture, which is 74 feet long, and I do not know how many feet high, and thought it a very commodious picture. We have seen pictures of martyrs enough, and saints enough, to regenerate the world. I ought not to confess it, but still, since one has no opportunity in America to acquire a critical judgment in art, and since I could not hope to become educated in it in Europe in a few short weeks, I may therefore as well acknowledge with such apologies as may be due, that to me, it seemed that when I had seen one of these martyrs I had seen them all. They all have a marked family resemblance to each other, they dress alike, in coarse monkish robes and sandals, they are all bald-headed, they all stand in about the same attitude, and without exception they are gazing heavenward with countenances which the Ainsworths, the Mortons and the Williamses, A. Phils, inform me are full of expression. To me there is nothing tangible about these imaginary portraits, nothing that I can grasp and take a living interest in. If great Titian had only been gifted with prophecy, and had skipped a martyr, and gone over to England, and painted a portrait of Shakespeare, even as a youth, which we could all have confidence in now, the world down to the latest generations would have forgiven him the lost martyr in the rescued seer. I think posterity could have spared one more martyr for the sake of a great historical picture of Titian's time, and painted by his brush, such as Columbus returning in chains from the discovery of a world, for instance. The old masters did paint some Venetian historical pictures, and these we did not tire of looking at, notwithstanding representations of the formal introduction of defunct doges to the Virgin Mary in regions beyond the clouds clashed rather harshly with the proprieties, it seemed to us. But humble as we are, and unpretending, in the matter of art, our researches among the painted monks and martyrs have not been wholly in vain. We have striven hard to learn. We have had some success. We have mastered some things, possibly of trifling import in the eyes of the learned, but to us they give pleasure, and we take as much pride in our little acquirements as do others who have learned far more, and we love to display them full as well. When we see a monk going about with a lion and looking tranquilly up to heaven, we know that that is Saint Mark. When we see a monk with a book and a pen, looking tranquilly up to heaven, trying to think of a word, we know that that is Saint Matthew. When we see a monk sitting on a rock, looking tranquilly up to heaven, with a human skull beside him, and without other baggage, we know that that is Saint Jerome. Because we know that he always went flying light in the matter of baggage. When we see a party looking tranquilly up to heaven, unconscious that his body is shot through and through with arrows, we know that that is Saint Sebastian. When we see other monks looking tranquilly up to heaven, but having no trademark, we always ask who those parties are. We do this, because we humbly wish to learn. We have seen 13,000 St. Jeromes, and 22,000 St. Marks, and 16,000 St. Matthews, and 60,000 St. Sebastians, and 4 millions of assorted monks, undesignated, and we feel encouraged to believe that, when we have seen some more of these various pictures, and... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.